Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Popcorn Science. In this podcast, we take a critical look at the science portrayed in our favorite movies and television shows. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Catherine Nisch. I'm a professor of earth sciences, a planetary geologist, and a fan of pop culture.
And I'm Dr. John Moores. I'm a professor of space engineering at York University, a planetary atmospheric scientist, a speculative fiction nerd, and for today, a proud Vinlander.
So today I got to pick the topic, and so I picked the 2011 movie Thor from the Marvel Cinematic Universe. I'm actually a big fan of the MCU, which is not something I know that's cool to say in 2025, especially as a 43-year-old woman, but I watched the whole series over the course of the pandemic with my husband after basically ignoring it during its original run. It started in 2008 with Iron Man, and it's still going on today. And I really fell in love with these characters, especially the characters of Thor and Loki, which are depicted in this movie. And then after watching it with my husband, we watched it with my 11-year-old daughter. And she's also a big fan now, so it's kind of become a family thing to watch the whole MCU together. So I'm excited to do this movie today. To give you a quick summary, this movie is about Thor, the Norse god of thunder. In the movie, he's banned from his homeworld of Asgard after attempting to incite a war with the Frost Giants. As a result, his father Odin banishes him to Earth, where he must live until he can prove himself worthy of his title. When he's on Earth, he meets and falls in love with Dr. Jane Foster, who's an astrophysicist studying Einstein-Rosen bridges. During his time on Earth, he has to sacrifice himself to save Jane from his power-hungry brother, Loki, and in the process, he restores his honor. In a final battle in Asgard, Loki is lost, and Thor mourns his loss, and also the lost connection he has with Jane.
You don't think this was just a magnetic storm, do you?
Look, the lensing around these edges is characteristic of an Einstein-Rosen bridge.
A what?
I thought you were a science major.
Political science.
She was the only applicant.
An Einstein-Rosen bridge is a theoretical connection between two different points of space-time.
The wormhole.
So it's an interesting story of families and love, and it's very Shakespearean in the end, which is actually interesting because it's directed by Kenneth Branagh, who is a famous Shakespearean actor. And there's a lot of famous Shakespearean actors in this as well, like Anthony Hopkins. Tom Hiddleston, who plays Loki, was recruited by Branagh after working with him. So there's that sort of Shakespearean element to this movie, which I also really enjoy. So, John, what's your background with the MCU?
It's pretty much non-existent, you know, I've got to say. It's something that I have generally avoided. I have seen a few of them, and the more comedic ones I've tended to be a fan of. So the Guardians of the Galaxy, at least before it became incomprehensible, I enjoyed that, definitely. It's probably that I just don't have the same sort of expansive view of the universe that you've got, because weird stuff happens between the movies that I don't know what's going on. But with this one in particular, I do remember seeing it and enjoying it. Maybe I didn't have quite the same reaction to it that you did, but I remember thinking last time when you picked this one that it was a strange choice. And I was wondering, gee, what are we going to talk about, you know, with a comic book movie? But I have to say, I think you made a pretty good choice here. I think, you know, having watched it, you know, this is a totally fair movie to gripe about in terms of the science. Like, I love that line that comes like an hour and 15 minutes in where he goes on about how, you know, your ancestors called it magic and you call it science. But where I come from, they're one and the same.
Yeah, we do have to be careful about our science gripes here, because clearly this is a comic book movie. Magic is just part of their world, right? So you can write off a lot of the stuff that they do as just magic, but it's still fun to think of it through a scientific lens. And actually, this movie had three science advisors who were picked for the movie through that science and entertainment exchange we talked about that was started as a consequence of the bad science portrayed in the core. So they did get some scientific input on this. Some of the things they changed was the fact that Dr. Jane Foster is an astrophysicist, which is not true in the comics. In the comics, she's a nurse. So they added that element of a woman in science doing astronomy research to the movie. They also hilariously changed the name of a wormhole to an Einstein-Rosen bridge because they thought wormhole was too dated. But it's essentially the same thing. I guess it sounded more technical.
Well, it is very techie, I think, and in a very 1930s, you know, in the way that they present things and in terms of the set design and whatnot. Like, it's not, to me, screaming Scandinavia of, you know, AD 1000. It feels very 1930s to me, just in the use of materials and the curves and that tech and watch component kind of structure to the place.
Yeah, I also like that they incorporated a lot of astronomy imagery into their set design. You know, obviously Asgard, you can see the stars, and so there's lots of Hubble imagery there incorporated. I guess they also used Hubble imagery to inspire their design of the Bifrost, the Rainbow Bridge that takes people from Asgard down to Earth and back. So I thought that was interesting how they incorporated astronomy into the set design basically throughout the movie.
Yeah, they're trying, and it's interesting, right? Because it's a movie where they didn't have to try. And when I watched it back in the day, I wasn't thinking of it, you know, in terms of the science impact, but I'm sure that other people were absorbing subconsciously. So it's good that there's a lot of stuff that we like about this one. But come on, we got to start with the stuff that we hate.
Sure, sure. So despite the fact, again, caveat, there is magic in the MCU, there is some science we can gripe about. So why don't we start with Mjolnir, which is Thor's hammer, which hilariously Kat Dennings, who plays Darcy in the movie, continually refers to as Mew-Mew, because she can't pronounce it. But I'll try to pronounce Mjolnir correctly. So Mjolnir is this hammer that Thor wields when he's worthy. When he's not worthy, he can't lift it up, and no one else who's unworthy can lift it. But I always wondered, how massive is this thing, right? If the unworthy cannot lift it. But it turns out that's just magic. According to Marvel, they issued a trading card in 1991 that stated its mass is 42.3 pounds. Very precise. So clearly it has some mass, and it's just magic that prevents you from lifting it or not. This also answers a question I've always had, which is how Thor can take his hammer up an elevator, right? If it was infinitely heavy, surely the elevator would crash, right? So it must have some mass, and the magic just must be what's preventing people from lifting it. So anyways, Mjolnir is just very magical. What's that?
Oh, I was just saying, there must be some smart materials going on there, because you can instruct the hammer. And also, when Thor becomes worthy again, the hammer provides his costume, which was very nice.
That's right. That's right. It also allows him to fly, mm-hmm. which is another thing I didn't totally understand. I guess, so I did some reading about how you could fly with a hammer, and it seems like there's two areas of thought on this. One is that he throws it, and then he just sort of hangs on to this heavy hammer that's getting thrown on a ballistic trajectory. Another one is that he can generate storms with the hammer, and then he gets lifted up by the air currents through the storms through Mjolnir. I don't know how magical that is versus how scientific.
Well, I guess we do forget he is the god of thunder, right? Those hammer blows, that's where, you know, you get that particular that particular effect coming from. Although I have to imagine, you know, that Google search, you know, how to fly with a hammer.
Yeah. Speaking of being the god of thunder, there's actually a funny line from one of the sequels to this, Thor Ragnarok from 2017, where he loses his hammer. It gets destroyed by his sister, so he can no longer use his hammer. And I think Odin, somebody reminds him that he's like, you're Thor, the god of thunder, not Thor, the god of hammers. And so then he finds his inner strength and uses his power of over thunder and weather to fight his sister.
Well, very good.
The other thing I've always wondered about with Mjolnir is how he gets it back, right? So he throws this hammer, and then he can instantly retract it back like a boomerang. But Mjolnir is not at all shaped like a boomerang. So I've always wondered what happens there. I was like, is it magnetism? What's going on for Thor to retrieve his hammer? Did you have any thoughts there?
Well, I feel like if you can fly with the thing to begin with, and you can, you know, tell it to do things and whisper to it, then getting it back is sort of like the minor part of this, right? If it knows you want it to come back, if it has the capability to help you to fly, then sure, it can come back on its own. It also seems to, you know, not really lose a lot of momentum when it's going through stuff. You know, some interesting properties to this thing.
It's true. It seems to have a mind of its own in a lot of ways.
Definitely.
So the other thing that really strikes me in Thor and in all the subsequent movies that involve Asgard is it's depicted as a flat planet, which is not something that forms in nature. Planets are spherical because they have to be massive enough to overcome the rigidity of their material and achieve what we call hydrostatic equilibrium. So you get this round or nearly round shape. It's actually in the definition of a planet. You have to be round enough to achieve hydrostatic equilibrium to be considered a planet. If you don't, you're not considered a planet. So Pluto, you know, got demoted, not for this reason, it is a sphere, but for other reasons. But if you're a small asteroid, you're too small to be a planet, for example.
Well, maybe what it is that Asgard is just not a member of the International Astronomical Union.
Sure. So the International Astronomical Union, or IAU, is the one that determines what makes a planet or not. And I'm guessing that Asgard is not part of it. But it also doesn't explain how gravity works there, right? Like, you see these waterfalls falling off the edge of Asgard. Loki falls to his quotey marks death, because he never dies, at the end of the movie. So how is gravity working? How do they stay stuck to the planet? It's very unclear. Again, it must be magic.
Well, it's a really highly engineered environment, it looks like. Yeah, like you say, there's no way Asgard would appear like this in nature. So it's something that feels very created. And I feel like all of the problems that we're running into here, maybe this is just my scientist brain operating, seem to go to the same thing. You know, that these are people who have control over gravity. And if you can do that, then your smart hammer can do a lot of weird looking things. You can have your nice disc world. You can even create yourself some good old fashioned wormholes. So everything is opened up if you've got that kind of control of gravity.
That's right. The other thing that Asgardians are a little bit different from humans is in their long life. So I don't know if you noticed this, John, but the movie actually opens up in, I think it's 965 AD. And Odin's there looking like a middle-aged man. Right. And then we cut to present day, which was 2011. Right. And now he just looks like an old man. And it's been over 1,000 years later. So clearly Asgardians live very long lives. I think Thor and Loki are supposed to be about 1500 years old during this movie for context. I don't know how old Odin is, but older than that. And so it gave me the question of, you know, could humans have a really long life? What gives them the long life? So I looked up what the oldest lifetimes any animals have on Earth. It turns out that clams can basically live forever. They found clams that are over 500 years old, and no one really knows why they live that long, which is interesting. In terms of vertebrates, there's a shark, a Greenland shark, that has been shown to live up to 400 years, and a bowhead whale that has lived more than 200 years. Humans obviously can live over 100 years, not 1,500 thousands of years, though. So I guess it's an active area of research. People are trying to figure out what lengthens a lifetime.
People like to live longer, right?
Yeah.
So that's and definitely I've seen people talk about, you know, oh, well, if you do some pretty severe calorie restriction and you get your metabolism down, then you can extend your life a little bit. And some of this might be what's going on with things like the Greenland shark that live in very cold environments. You know, that, you know, don't eat a lot, don't process things very quickly. They're kind of living this slow motion sort of life. And it just took me back to thinking about Stephen Jay Gould and his theory that, you know, every mammal gets a billion heartbeats. That's how it works, because the smaller animals tend to move faster. They tend to have faster heartbeats, and the bigger animals tend to have slower heartbeats. But the total number in a lifetime is actually fairly constant within a factor of a few.
Yeah, like I said, this is an area of active research. It's not something we really understand very well. One paper I did find, though, that proposed that age-related declines are related to our mitochondria, which is a part of our cells, which has its own DNA. And so maybe if you had changes in your mitochondrial content and function, that it could actually extend your lifetime. So this is an area I think people are looking into, because obviously, as you said, people are interested in living longer. I don't know if I'd want to live for thousands of years, but certainly, you know, having a good long life is preferred. So, and I also thought you put some notes in here about how different species might perceive the passage of time. So it'd be interesting to think of how the Asgardians, who live for thousands of years, perceive time and how that would affect you falling in love with a human who lives for such a much shorter time period, right? So that's some interesting things to consider too.
It is a topic I think that the Lord of the Rings in particular gets into quite a bit with the movies, the idea of, you know, if you have different species of different longevities, you know, how that affects relationships between them.
Yes, if you keep watching the movies, John, you'll see that it doesn't really matter because, yeah, Jane dies, spoilers, at the end of Thor: Love and Thunder and goes to Valhalla.
Oh, no.
Yeah. She gets cancer, so that's the topic of that movie. And Thor goes on sad, and perhaps we'll see him. He's slated to appear in the next Avengers movie, so we'll see how that all shakes out.
Well, very good. Well, I have to say, I think this particular movie is a little less biological than some of the other ones that we've looked at in the past, but there's still a few things, the longevity thing, and something else I wanted to bring up on that sort of biology side of things is, you know, what was going on over in the other realm with the Frost Giants.
Mm-hmm.
And I need to come up with my own, you know, baby talk term for that one, I think.
Jotunheim? You don't like that?
Yes. I don't know. It gives me some trouble, I think, just in the memory. I don't have that learned capacity, I don't think, you know, of that cadence. You know, there's lots of things to talk about with the Frost Giants, but they, of course, unleash a gigantic monster because, you know, how can you not have a gigantic monster that moves very quickly and whatnot? And you see this all the time in movies. It does drive me a little bit nuts because of this little thing we call the square cube law. If you're talking about the strength of a muscle, it depends on the cross-sectional area of a muscle. If you're talking about the stuff that muscle's got to move, it depends on the volume, and therefore, you know, how much material there is. And this is the reason that an ant can lift 50 times its own mass, why a grasshopper can jump like 20 or 30 times its own length. And we can't do anything like that because we're much bigger. And as animals get bigger and bigger, they tend to get more and more sluggish because the relative effort to do things with a larger and larger body gets larger and it grows very quickly. So these really fast, although never faster than the protagonists, I gotta say. Whenever I see those, it's like, oh, can we not this time?
Although he very quickly kills this monster simply by throwing a giant hammer at him. So it turns out it wasn't that much of a threat in the end.
It's true. That hammer is helpful in many situations, except in the ones when it's not.
That's right. Well, and that's why he's so devastated when he loses it, right? It's his buddy, Mjolnir. The other biological thing I thought was interesting was the Odin sleep, which is also related to the size of an animal, at least on Earth. And so in the movie, Odin kind of collapses and goes into what they call the Odin sleep. It sounds an awful lot like hibernation, what he's going into here, this sleep to renew himself. I don't entirely know the background on this. So I looked up a little bit about hibernation, and it seems like there's no evidence that humans can hibernate, although we clearly have a common ancestor that did because other mammals do this. So maybe there is some innate capacity there to figure out how to hibernate, but currently no evidence that humans do this. It also seems to be related to the size of the animal, where smaller animals tend to hibernate, whereas larger animals like bears go into a state of what's called torpor. So this is not something actually I realized until recently, is that bears do not hibernate. This is a sort of a misnomer that got propagated throughout society, but they go into the state of torpor, where again, their metabolism is slow, their breathing and heart rate slow, but you can wake up from it. You're not so deep in sleep that you can't be roused if there's some sort of danger, which is not seemingly what Odin is doing. He seems to be hibernating. It seems very difficult to rouse him from this Odin sleep. So again, this doesn't seem to jive with what we see on Earth, where only the smaller animals are able to hibernate, whereas larger animals go into torpor.
Well, it certainly sounds like Odin would be the ideal long-duration spaceflight astronaut in that case.
Absolutely. But they don't need long-duration astronauts on Asgard because you can just use the Bifrost to go anywhere you want.
I know. That thing is efficient. We should talk some more about that and how it interacts, you know, with the Earth. And I've got to say, I think within the first 5 minutes of this movie, I was like, oh, I know why Catherine likes this one, because it has that very X-Filesy opening to it.
It is pretty great. Yeah, so it opens with Jane and her colleague, Dr. Selvig, and her intern, Darcy, racing around in a bus in the New Mexico desert looking for, like, storm chasing, basically, which is not something astronomers typically do. Astronomers are not storm chasers. So I don't know how she got put onto this area of research. I think she mentioned they look like aurora, so maybe that's what she was trying to study, but they're racing around looking for these Einstein-Rosen bridges, which look like tornadoes for some reason, which I also didn't understand. I'm not sure why a wormhole would create a tornado or any storm at all. Anyway, so they're racing around. They see one of these, and then they bump into Thor, who's been deposited on Earth through the Bifrost. And he's fine. I guess he's strong enough that the car impact doesn't hurt him. But I thought this was kind of a weird thing, A, for astronomers to be doing. Also, she mentions that they're very predictable events, which, again, if it's just people randomly being thrown around by the Bifrost, I don't know why that would be predictable, right? It seems like it's just a transport system. You can just show up, ask Heimdall, and then go wherever you want. So I don't know where the predictability came from there and why she was expecting to see one.
Yeah, interesting. It's New Mexico, right? So I guess that's where the aliens and other mythology come from too. This is definitely one of those ones that is taking mythology and trying to explain it, you know, in factual ways.
Yeah, but why is Thor showing up in New Mexico and not Norway? It's right. Is he tired of the cold? He wants a little summer vacation. I'm not sure why he ends up in New Mexico so often.
I will say that the way that these things actually are manifested, you know, that tornado-like thing looks an awful lot like old animations of these wormholes, where you have sort of this flat wire mesh plane, and then this you know, tornado-like thing extends out of it, and that's the wormhole. So I do wonder if that could be the inspiration here. Plus, it's dramatic.
Yeah, and I mean, he is the god of thunder, right? So maybe wherever he goes, storms follow, and that's somehow related. I don't know. It's not exactly defined in any way. But that's fine. Again, it's a comic book movie. There's magic involved. I will cut it some slack.
A little suspension of disbelief is a good thing.
Yeah. However, I do know something about astronomy. And so it was interesting to see how Jane worked with her team as a newly minted astrophysicist. I looked up her history. Apparently, during this movie, she's a postdoc. So this is a job you get after graduating with your PhD at the fictional Culver University, which explains why they don't have a lab at a university, because Virginia is nowhere near New Mexico, which is another thing I thought was weird. They just seemed to rent out a place in the middle of this fictional New Mexico town and set up their base of operations there. I don't know where she's getting all this money. I guess she has a really good NSF grant or something to study wormholes. So it's sort of strange to see an astrophysicist working out of an abandoned storefront in a New Mexico town in general. It was also weird that she had a political science intern. I get that she was the only applicant, that's the joke, but I don't know how useful an intern who knows nothing about astronomy would be if you're doing an astrophysics internship.
It's true, although, you know, as much as I love Kat Dennings, I have to say, it seems mostly it's making comedic remarks and driving the bus.
Yes, no, that is her main goal here.
So. Definitely not required to do as much as Clara was, for instance.
So anyways, it was interesting as an astronomer to see how they depicted an astronomer in this movie. The other thing, and again, this might just be me being a bad scientist, is Jane has this very important notebook that they're chasing around. It has all her notes in it. But I rarely take notes on paper, nor would I like print out a color HST photo, Hubble Space Telescope photo, and like tape it in there as she appears to do. I know there are some anachronists among me, and perhaps I'm the exception and Jane is the rule. I don't know.
Well, I don't know about printing out an HST photo and putting it in my notebook, but I definitely keep a notebook that I would be terrified to lose. And I enjoy my fountain pens, Catherine.
I'm just too impatient, I think, to write things down. I learned how to type in seventh grade, and ever since then, it's been far more efficient just to type things out into a computer than to write them down with a pen and paper. So maybe that's where my bias comes from.
Well, maybe on that note of mild disagreement, we should take just a couple minutes here, and we'll be right back with the Science Shine and the things that we enjoyed. Right. Welcome back. And you know what, Catherine? Why don't we pick up where we left off here with the Einstein-Rosen bridges? Because I think there's a few things about the way that they handled the Bifrost that really impressed you.
Well, I don't know how much it impressed me, but I just want to talk a little about wormholes, because this is a concept within physics that people talk about a lot. So they were right there to talk about it as a potential way of transporting people between different planets. And presumably Asgard is a different planet than Earth, and you need some quick way to transport yourself between them. So, hey, let's use a wormhole, which they didn't want to call a wormhole. So they called it an Einstein-Rosen bridge. And so this is what comes out of the math of general relativity. It was developed by Einstein. And it turns out that if you form a black hole, you get something called a white hole attached to it. And if you pair these up, a black and a white hole, you form a wormhole. And so this is a solution that comes out of general relativity. But it turns out that white holes probably don't exist because they're very unstable. And the other issue is that the wormhole entrance is within the event horizon of a black hole. And you really do not want to get anywhere near a black hole, which is infinite density, right? So in fact, a wormhole designed with this Einstein-Rosen bridge with the black hole and the white hole probably wouldn't work. So it's kind of funny that they decided to use this word for it when that solution of general relativity probably doesn't work. There are ways to make wormholes work, but they either involve negative mass, which we don't think exists, or negative energy, which might exist, but we just don't know much about it. People are actively trying to figure this out. Could you make a wormhole? How would it work? How would you get that negative energy to exist and form a stable wormhole? But like I said, in theory, through general relativity, you can kind of think of ways to make this work.
So one of the nice things, of course, about this, once you accept that this is a device that works, and in theory it could if you had these exotic things, you can go to all sorts of interesting places, and some of the places they visit that are not the Earth and not Asgard actually have a little bit more reality to them. So with, let me try it again, Jotunheim, here you have a very interesting planet with a big contrast in temperature, and I think you caught that there's something about the stellar system that might actually support that.
Well, I thought it was interesting that they called Jotunheim a realm of cold and darkness, which to me immediately spoke of maybe it's a tidally locked planet where only one side of the planet can see the star and the other side is continually in darkness. We talked about this a little bit during our podcast with Clara, where you get these tidally locked planets, especially around M dwarfs in the habitable zone. There could be lots and lots of these habitable planets out there, and maybe Jotunheim is one of them. When they pull out on Jotunheim, it does appear to be illuminated by a star. So it's not like it's a rogue planet or something that where it has no star system nearby to illuminate it. So that was the best guess I could have for why Jotunheim was this realm of cold and darkness.
Well, I really like that. And of course, the denizens of Jotunheim, the frost giants, they've all got the blue skin. And you had, I recall when we were chatting about this, you felt maybe that's camouflage. Maybe it blends them into their icy surroundings. But for me, the thing that really pinged was, you know, that color blue. I do a lot of work with optics and atmospheric optics. And you also see a lot of color in different animals, birds in particular. And blue is so hard for nature to make. You've got all these other pigments. You want to do any of those? They're great. Those are essentially compounds where you've got light that comes in and it absorbs everything except for the color that it looks like. But blue is hard. And yet we do see birds with the color blue out there. And that has to do with the microstructure of how these things are set up. You create these interference patterns that gives rise to blue color. I don't know that that's what the frost giants are doing, but you definitely see that in nature. And that combined with the Bifrost, which is based on rain bones, made it really interesting for me that you had examples in this of both kinds of ways of playing with color. You have that refraction, like a prism, where you have the water droplets in a rainbow that break up the light. And then you have, you know, this color blue and other diffractive kinds of effects, like what you get with a CD to, you know, if you ever look at that in the light. I may be dating myself. Maybe some of our listeners have never heard of this compact disc business that, you know, I'm mentioning here, but I always enjoy playing with this a little bit. And we also, in terms of color, talk a little bit about the aurora in the movie as well. And one thing I really liked is that you do actually get auroras in a place like New Mexico from time to time.
That's right. We talked about that during, I think, the core as well, how you can get more southerly apparitions of the aurora. No, but this stuck out to me because the frost giants are blue. I recently finished watching Star Trek Enterprise, and there's a prominent character in that who's also blue. He's an Andorian who also comes from a very cold planet. So I'm like, why are all these sci-fi shows equating blue characters to cold planets? And so I was just guessing that maybe it's related to camouflage. But when you look at the Earth, right, polar bears are white. Now, they don't live in a realm of cold and darkness, right? I mean, it is light half the year. But yeah, polar bears have white fur with black skin. So you think that might be more likely for an Arctic animal like a polar bear or a frost giant or an Andorian. So it's not clear to me why they chose blue, unless maybe there's something unusual about their star or an overabundance of some element on their planet. Unclear.
It's true, although I have to take this one step further and mention that the people that seem to come from hot planets do tend more towards the warmer colors of the spectrum, too, to get more of those sorts of reds and yellows and whatnot. In some cases, when you have, you know, people that are allegedly made of rock, tend to get some of those warmer colors.
Well, or you mentioned Guardians of the Galaxy. There's a prominent green character. I don't know why Gamora is green. For instance, you know, Nebula, her sister, is also blue, but she's been heavily manipulated by Thanos, who is purple. So there's lots of colorful people in the MCU.
And I understand from my very mild reading that there is a prominent red character that people are not all the fan of.
Oh, which one in particular are you talking about?
I think there was something called the Red Hulk, which very much confused
me.
Oh,
the Red Hulk. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Actually, he showed up in the very last movie, the new Captain America movie, played by Harrison Ford. yeah, yeah. I don't know why he's red and the Hulk is green. That gamma radiation, man, can do some funny things.
I know, the coloration. I do feel like with the Orions on Star Trek, it was just like, okay, this is a way that we can, you know, like create another difference. Just to make something a little bit exotic.
Right. But I don't know how much they actually thought about this. Ice is blue. We'll make the frost giants blue. We'll make the Andorians blue. But the other interesting thing I thought about the frost giants is that they can actually freeze things just by touching them, which was interesting to me because that implies that their body temperature is below the freezing point of water at 0 degrees Celsius, right? So I actually looked this up, and there is actually evidence that mammals can have body temperatures below freezing. The lowest temperature recorded for a mammal is -3 degrees Celsius, which is the Arctic ground squirrel, but they only achieve this during hibernation. Otherwise, their body temperature is obviously above zero, so that wouldn't work for the frost giants. The other thing I thought is maybe they've got some sort of antifreeze in their blood, you know, that can lower their body temperature. You know, ammonia can do this, other salts can do this, but I did think it was interesting that they were able to freeze surfaces when we don't have any evidence of mammals that can do that.
Well, it's true. They would have to be very highly conductive as well to pull the energy out of something else quite quickly. The mammals surviving at very low temperatures just reminds me of the wilderness first aid training, which is, you know, you're not dead until you're warm and dead.
Until you're warm and dead?
Yeah, yeah. If you are cold, you know, you can actually persist longer without getting brain damage.
Oh, interesting. Interesting. So the one thing I was really impressed with, though, was the impact crater that Mjolnir makes when it comes flying down to Earth after Thor. And I was like, oh, clearly they didn't get this right. Nobody knows what an impact crater is supposed to look like. But I did my best to estimate its size by looking at the humans who were there in the crater trying to pull up the hammer. And so I'm guessing the depth to me looked like maybe 3 humans. So I'm guessing that's like 18 feet. And the radius looked like maybe 8 humans. So I'm guessing I'm going to say is 6 feet tall. So that's 48 feet. And that actually is pretty close to what you'd expect for a depth diameter ratio for a simple crater, which is about 1/5. So I was like, okay, that's pretty close. Then I went to an impact crater calculator to see what sort of size of crater Mjolnir would produce if it hit the Earth at impact velocities that are typical for asteroids striking the Earth. And it works out to be about the right size if it has the density of iron. So that's interesting. Again, going back to its composition. If it impacted at a slower velocity, then you could have an even higher density. So that all kind of works out with Mjolnir creating this impact crater. It had some weird rings in it that wouldn't exist in nature. I guess maybe they were trying to make it look like Captain America's shield. I don't know what they were going for there. But yeah, craters don't usually have those rings in them.
Hmm. Yeah, there were, what was it? There was language or runes where Thor showed up and down on the ground. There was an imprint of something.
Yeah, well, that's a science gripe. Why did Mjolnir make a crater and Thor didn't? Thor's bigger than Mjolnir, so he should make a bigger crater than the hammer.
Well, I would say if a human being was running into Earth at 17 kilometers a second, you might have bigger problems than just, you know, how big a crater you make.
It's true. Why didn't Thor vaporize when he struck the planet? I mean, he is strong, but I don't know if he's that strong. So there are some problems there with delivering humans to Earth, making an impact crater through a wormhole. But for Mjolnir, it kind of checks out. So I was happy with that.
That's true. They only control gravity when they want to.
That's right.
So there were a few things, I think, you know, once you go above the atmosphere, that were interesting and accurate. So there is one thing that stuck out to me, and that was the animation of the Van Allen belts that actually shows up when Jane is out storm chasing for Aurora in the southern U.S. And they are the actual Van Allen belts. And they are also a geomagnetic phenomena. They're not really well connected to the Aurora. It's more a hazard for spacecraft, because these are zones where you can have charged particles accumulate and not actually go anywhere. Whereas with the Aurora, you have these charged particles that come in down through the magnetic poles, and they interact with the atmosphere to give you those pretty colors. But it is an accurate thing. It is an interesting thing. I was impressed by that. And then if you go out to Asgard, I think there was something about the Asgardian sky that really felt right to you.
Well, I just noticed there were like a ton of stars and nebula that you could see. And I wondered if that meant that Asgard was located near the galactic center where the star density is higher. And I did some Googling, and it seems like that is sort of the idea, that the realms of Asgard and its cousins do exist near the galactic center. So they did sort of think about that and incorporate that into their visuals there, which, you know, can you imagine being on a planet near the galactic center? The stars would look totally different at night, right? We're kind of on the outskirts of the galaxy, kind of in the boondocks, where so the star density is pretty low, but it'd be really rad to be near the galactic center. I mean, maybe not great for life, but, you know, for a moment there, it'd be very nice stargazing.
Oh, definitely. There's a few places, I think, in the galaxy that would be interesting to get a picture of it. There's a image, actually not the galactic core, but, you know, out at the edges of the spiral arms that Isaac Asimov talks about. In his Foundation novels, he talks about this idea of being able to see the galaxy rise in the night sky. Mm. And Carl Sagan picks up on this a little bit and talks about, you know, galaxy rise as well from different perspectives. I think it's just fascinating the differences in the sky that you can get in different places. And they actually made those changes.
Yeah, yeah. And the end scene, I don't know if you watched the credits. The credits for Marvel are always amazing. But I guess they based that on a bunch of different Hubble Space Telescope images. And it apparently took 18 months to do that end credit sequence. So maybe if you didn't stick around to watch that, take a moment and give that a rewatch as well. It's quite beautiful.
I guess I'll have to take a look at that.
Yeah. The other thing I thought was interesting was how Mjolnir was formed. Speaking about stars, they very clearly say it was forged in the heart of a dying star. And at first I was like, well, how the heck would you extract a hammer from the middle of a dying star, which is either like a white dwarf or a neutron star? A neutron star has a density of 10 to the 17th kilograms per meter cubed, which is a kind of a meaningless number, but it's close to a billion million times the density of the Earth. So this is a huge density. I was like, well, how would you get a hammer out of that? But then I paused the movie when they're reading that children's book about Mjolnir, and I'll read what it says to you here. It says, "The blacksmiths used the core of a star as a mold. In the process, the star exploded and almost took Earth with it," which I thought was interesting, because you can get a neutron star to explode if it collides with another neutron star, and they can collide and form a black hole. So maybe they forged Mjolnir in the heart of a neutron star, it collided with another neutron star, it exploded, and then Mjolnir came, I don't know, rocketing out of there as it's wont to do. Fortunately, this would probably not take Earth out with it. We don't see any nearby black holes. And even if they were nearby, they would just bathe the Earth in cosmic radiation. So not good for life, not good for us, but it wouldn't destroy the Earth in the process. So that's good news.
Yeah, if only they could do it on the surface of a neutron star, then you could have one of those nice little standard candle supernovas, you know, to get it dislodged.
That's right. That's right. There is a scene in a later movie where, because Thor has lost his hammer, and so he has to make a new hammer. It's called, well, it's more like an axe, Stormbreaker. And so he goes back and has to harness the energy of a star in order to form this new weapon. It's quite a dramatic scene, not very realistic from a scientific point of view, but he does get a cool axe out of it.
Hey, I'm glad that we get to see how it's actually done.
That's right. Any other science shine you wanted to discuss before we move on, John?
I think that's most of it. I mean, the one thing that I found really interesting in just looking into this, they don't belabor the aurora very much. And initially, I was thinking that that might be a gripe. You know, like, we're talking about a culture here near the North Pole, or nearer to the North Pole, you know, and of course with North mythology, you know, there are manifestations in pretty much every natural phenomenon. So why not the aurora? I actually took some time and looked it up, and shockingly, the aurora essentially does not show up in the sagas at all. Which surprised me. There is this, if you look online, you're going to find a lot about how, you know, maybe the aurora is actually Bifrost, or it's the reflection of the armor of the Valkyries, you know, so you see the aurora, you know, it's like somebody's just died type of thing, like that red sky thing. And apparently, no. And there's actually people who are wondering why that is. Maybe something to do with geomagnetic activity at the time, maybe the location of the magnetic pole at the time. So I thought that was an interesting rabbit hole to go down looking at this movie. So, you know, you learn new things.
That is interesting. I hadn't heard that. I will say I've been desperate to see a good aurora, and I've never seen a really good aurora in my life. I've seen some mediocre ones, but I actually booked a trip to Alaska in January a couple years ago. I saw no aurora, despite being in Fairbanks in January. But as you said, it wasn't the right geomagnetic conditions. So it's not like you always get the aurora up north. There have to be very specific conditions in place.
That's true. I remember thinking when I visited Vancouver Island once, you know, like, is that the aurora? That must be the aurora. And then I went to North Slope, Alaska. And it's like, no, this is the aurora.
Yeah. Yep, one day, fingers crossed. That's my goal. It's on my bucket list.
No, I'm pulling for you, Catherine.
Thanks.
All right, we'll be right back with the Of Its Time section. So welcome back. This is the point of the show where we talk about what is it with this movie that sort of situates it in deepest, darkest 2011 and makes us maybe, you know, remember some of the good old days, but as being distinct from today. And I think you had a really good point. There's this point where I think Thor's friends walk into town in full regalia, and the members of, what is it, S.H.I.E.L.D.?
S.H.I.E.L.D., that's
there.
Right.
Okay. They're there, you know, surveilling the town, and they call out about a couple of people who've come in, and they refer to them as, what is it, Xena, Jackie Chan, and Robin Hood?
That's right. Yeah. And so I was like, would people know who these people are nowadays? And I think people know who Robin Hood is. That's a classic legend.
Timeless.
Yeah. Jackie Chan, similarly timeless. But I'm not sure how many people would know who Xena, Warrior Princess, is at this point. It was very popular, you know, when we were kids. What was that, late 90s came out? Yeah. A very popular TV show, but I'm sure my kids have no idea who Xena Warrior Princess is at this point. So I wonder if that reference would just go over people's heads at this point.
Yeah, I think that's probably one of the worst offending bits for me. They do mention iPods in there as well.
That's right. Which I thought was already a little anachronistic. So when S.H.I.E.L.D. raids their lab and they take all their gear, their computers, their notes, Darcy seems very sad that she lost her iPod. But by 2011, you know, even iPods were on their way out. Everyone had just a phone, and iPods themselves looked like phones. I had one at the time. It was just a phone without the ability to call anyone. That's what it looked like. So I thought that was kind of funny that she seemed concerned about her iPod and not her iPhone.
Now, I think that this is just a very clever reference to Nick and Nora's Infinite Playlist, which is another wonderful, delightful Kat Dennings film that it just, I don't think that the rating on IMDb is right. Sorry.
All right. I haven't seen that one, so I can't comment. But Kat Dennings does come back in several other of these Marvel movies. If you're a fan, you can watch Thor the Dark World next. But speaking of the MCU, this was one of the first Marvel movies. So it was the fourth after Iron Man, Iron Man 2, and The Incredible Hulk. So this really started sort of kicked off this huge movie franchise that it continues to this day. And this was one of the first entries into it. So at the time, it was pretty new, pretty unknown. But I think it'd be hard to go nowadays without anyone knowing what Marvel is. So it's kind of cool to see how it all started here, especially with a lot of the actors who were pretty much unknowns at the time. And now they're superstars.
Is there anybody who is not in the Marvel universe somewhere? I'm starting to wonder, like you mentioned a few minutes ago, Harrison Ford. Harrison Ford is in the MCU. Oh my goodness.
Yeah. So interestingly, I looked this up. This was the first Marvel movie, mind you, it was only the fourth one, that didn't have an Oscar-winning or Oscar-nominated villain. I'm not sure who you'd call the villain in this, if it's Loki or... I don't know. I love Loki. He's my favorite character. But I never took him as a villain. He's more of a misunderstood, you know, frustrated person for obvious reasons. I mean, his father didn't treat him very well, so...
God of mischief.
Yeah, he's more mischievous than a villain. Anti-hero, I think, is what you could call him. So I'm not sure who the villain in this even is. It's more just like a family drama than anything else.
No, definitely. And it's interesting that, of course, this was directed by Kenneth Branagh, who's someone, you know, this is a big-time director with really good credits, a lot of, you know, wonderful Shakespearean stuff to his name. And as you mentioned earlier, Catherine, this one has the same kind of, I think, Shakespearean structure to it, which is familiar.
Yeah, yeah. And actually, it was really funny to read about this movie and see why the actors decided to take these roles. And several of them said they basically did it because Kenneth Branagh was directing it. And I'll quote what Natalie Portman said on why she took the role. She said, "I just thought it sounded like a weird idea because Kenneth Branagh is directing it." So I was like, Kenneth Branagh doing Thor is super weird. I've got to do it. And there were similar sentiments from Stellan Skarsgård, who plays Dr. Erik Selvig, and Idris Elba, who plays Heimdall. They're all like, Kenneth Branagh is doing Thor? That's weird. Let's do it. But I did love how he brought that sort of Shakespearean themes to the movie. And I know he directed the actors this way. I know Tom Hiddleston took that really seriously in his role to try to make Loki this sort of Shakespearean character basing on different Shakespearean folks. So I really like that about it. And it carries on into the subsequent movies, I think, this sort of Shakespearean family drama between Thor and Loki and Odin and everyone.
Yeah, it's interesting. The directors change up a little bit. So I noticed that this particular series has other people who, you know, had just sort of, you know, shown up as big new hot directors on the scene. And then, like, let's have them direct one of these movies as well. And it gets really interesting, different kind of texture to it. So I think the other one in this series that I think I've seen is the Ragnarok one. Just so, so different in terms of tone and style. And I always like that when one of these properties can sort of play with something and not be too serious. And I do worry sometimes that the MCU, at least, you know, from an outsider's perspective, does kind of take itself a bit too serious sometimes.
Well, and I think that's why Thor Ragnarok is considered the best of the Thor movies, because it does start to introduce that element of humor that was a little bit lacking from the original Thor movie and definitely lacking from Thor the Dark World, its sequel. And it really showed off the fact that the actors could be comedians, right? You know, and I think now Chris Hemsworth is known as sort of a comedic actor, whereas in this first movie, it was very subtle on the comedy, I would say. It took itself a lot more seriously. But then they took it kind of to the other extreme with Thor Love and Thunder, which came out in 2022, and a lot of people thought it was too silly, and I would agree with that. So there's that fine line to walk, right, between the Shakespearean drama and the comedy, and I think they found it there in Ragnarok, and unclear where they're going to, you know, end up in the future.
Comedy's hard that way, but it is interesting. I do wonder what it must be like on some of these productions, especially one like this with Kenneth Branagh, like the actors that he's able to get to show up for a movie, especially his recent stuff with Agatha Christie and Inspector Poirot. Mm. It just seems like people having some fun, and then they roll the cameras and something comes out of that.
Yeah, no, I definitely think he was responsible for a lot of the great acting that was in this movie and continued throughout the MCU. I think he specifically asked, for example, Idris Elba to participate in this movie, who's a great actor, but Heimdall's kind of a bit part in a way. And he even had to overcome some like ridiculous racist boycotts by the Council of Conservative Citizens, who didn't want to have a black man play a Nordic god, which he called ridiculous, which it is. He's amazing in this movie. He continues throughout the series in this role, and I can't imagine anyone else in this role. And so props to Kenneth Branagh for getting him to participate in this movie.
Oh, goodness. As my wife knows, I will watch anything with Idris Elba in it. And, you know, a movie with Kat Dennings and Idris Elba, I mean...
Well, you know, here you go.
A good one.
You gotta watch the rest of the Thor movies then, John.
I guess so.
The other thing I thought was interesting was the inclusion of Natalie Portman in this movie, who was well known at this point for being in the Star Wars franchise, but actually took some time off from her acting career to get a degree at Harvard, which I hadn't appreciated. So she actually has some science chops to her credit. She pursued a degree in psychology. She participated in neurobiology research when she was at Harvard. She made it to the semifinals of the Intel Science Talent Search when she was in high school. So she's actually, you know, has a bit of a science background. So it was great for her to play this role of Dr. Jane Foster. And when asked about balancing her career and education, she said, "I don't care if college ruins my career. I'd rather be smart than a movie star." And that's kind of a cool way to look at things. So props to Natalie Portman for bringing that science background to this role.
I do really appreciate that. And I like that they upgraded her character and gave her some independence and some intelligence and, you know, fleshed things out a little bit. I mean, okay, she still sputters whenever Thor takes his shirt off. But at the same time...
Don't we all?
It's true, even me a little bit. So, you know, it's nice to see that kind of development, I think. And you're starting to see that in the 2011 sort of era.
Yeah, and it continues on throughout the Thor movies. By the last movie, we see that she's written a book called The Foster Theory, Space and Time Travel. And she's explaining it to this other cancer patient. He's reading it. It is a bit presumptuous to name a theory after yourself, I will say. But, you know, she put a lot of time and effort into it, so.
Okay, there you go. So I think a good place to end with this might be to bring it back to the good old science fiction and to say, they mention in this, like we said at the start, that, you know, you've got the magic, you've got the science, and maybe they're just two sides of the same coin. And we even get a quotation of Arthur C. Clarke's famous, "Any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic." I think the quote that you caught was, "Magic was just science we don't understand yet."
Yeah. So I think they're clearly riffing off of Arthur C. Clarke's famous quote there. And I love that interplay. You know, maybe there is aspects about Asgardian science that we don't understand and we'll call it magic. Maybe there were aliens that visited Norway 1,000 years ago and they were so sufficiently advanced that the Vikings didn't know the difference between magic and science. So it's an interesting concept to think about during this movie. And I thought they played with that well.
Agreed. If you like other cultures, there's always Stargate, of course, for, you know, Egyptian culture with the same kind of idea of magic and science, seeing two sides of the same coin there. So maybe we should go ahead and leave it there. And in a minute, we'll come back with the ratings.
All right. Welcome back, everyone. So this is the part of the show where we rate the movie in terms of its scientific accuracy, its influence on society, and how it holds up over time. We rate things on a scale of 1 to 5. So let's start with scientific accuracy. What rating did you give this movie, John?
So I give this one a middle of the road kind of rating, a number 3. When I remember seeing it the first time, I wasn't thinking science. And now that I'm watching it again and paying attention for, you know, the science shine and the science gripes, it feels like it's not doing a bad job. It's got some really good advice in places. There are places where it's ridiculous, but I can suspend my disbelief there. So I'm going to give it a middle of the road because what it chooses to do well scientifically, it does do well.
Fair enough. I gave it a slightly lower score of a 2 because they do use a lot of magic in this that they don't even attempt to explain. I also thought the depiction of Jane Foster as an astrophysicist was a little bit off. I don't see astronomers like her in my day-to-day life. So I like that she was an astronomer, but That's not what astronomers do. However, there were a couple things that I thought were cool, especially that impact crater, Mjolnir's impact crater. The fact that it was roughly the right size and shape was pretty cool. I wasn't expecting that. So not the bottom of the barrel, but I'll give it a 2. All right, John. So this movie is now 14 years old. How has it influenced society, science fiction, you? What would you put it at?
So I'm clearly cheating on this one. I put down 2 numbers instead of 1. And I said either a 2 or a 4. And what I mean by that is how you look at it. I didn't perceive this as a science movie that was trying to do the science right. I just, you know, thought it was a comic book movie and fun with magic when I saw it the first time. For the scientific community, I don't know many people who point at Thor and say, hey, you know, the core, it really screwed up, but Thor got it right. You know, I haven't really seen that influence. But in terms of a movie that has influenced popular culture and that has been seen by many people and had many sequels made of it and being part of this, you know, overall cultural thing, it's got to be quite high. I mean, I put down 4, but now that I say it, I wonder if that's almost too low.
Yeah, I also put down a 4 just because of the huge influence I think the Marvel Cinematic Universe has had on our culture. I never read comic books as a child, but now I know about these comic book characters and their histories and their backgrounds, and, you know, and I really enjoy learning about their lives. And I do wonder if, you know, any young girls were inspired by Dr. Jane Foster to see a scientist, you know, on the big screen to pursue that in the future, or at least see that it was possible. So overall, yeah, I think it has pretty high influence. All right. And how does it hold up? What would you put the ranking there?
Catherine may have noticed that I just slightly edited this one. And the reason for that is that I felt, you know, this could be a movie that was created today for all intents and purposes, partially because the setting that they pick, even though it's a bit dated, that I think fits with that rural setting that it takes place in. But I think we talked a little bit too much about Xena Warrior Princess and Jackie Chan I love, but I worry he might not be as timeless as Robin Hood. And so I think I just take the smallest deduction and put it at 4.5.
I gave it a 4. I think it holds up pretty well. I actually had a lot of trouble with the of its time section because there were so few things in it that really placed it in time. It's sort of timeless in a way. So that was cool. And the effects still look pretty good here 14 years out. So I still really enjoy watching this movie. Of the 4 Thor movies, it's probably my second favorite after Ragnarok.
Well, good to know. I'll have to lead up to that one.
That's right. All right. Any final thoughts, John, before we wrap things up?
No, I think I'll leave the last word to you.
All right. Well, until next time, whosoever listens to this podcast, if they be worthy, shall possess the power of Thor.
Popcorn Science is hosted by Catherine Niche and John Moores, with Catherine taking the lead on pre-production, sourcing clips, and writing show notes, and John taking the lead on post-production and sound editing. Artwork for the show is provided by science illustrator Michelle Parsons, while Sean Nock handles web hosting and ensures that our conversations make their way to your favorite podcasting service.